Everybody, hello, and welcome to the first session of Track B in the 2014 Ontology Summit. Today is January 30th, and my co-champion, Alan Rector, and I would like to welcome all of you to this session, and in particular the three panelists, Till Mosakowski, Chris Welty, and, well, Alan Rector will act in a dual role today. He's both a co-champion of this track, but today he will also be one of the panelists. So let me give a brief introduction to this overall track. I'm now going to slide 2 of this chair intro presentation. A short version of the mission statement that we put up for track B is that the web of data provides great opportunities for ontology-based services, but it also puts challenges to tools for example, for editing and using ontologies, for managing ontologies in any possible way. And the web of data, because it's so big, also puts challenges to techniques for ontology engineering, such as ontology engineering methodologies. Whenever I say web of data here, it's meant to subsume things that we know as big data on the web, but also as the semantic web. And when we say semantic web in the context of this track B, we really mean the web in its whole size and extension, not just, well, small ontologies using URIs as identifiers for symbols. So, slide 3, research questions that we would like to address in this track and that we would like to discuss with all of you in this session by talking, also by writing questions and answers into the chat and also on the mailing list. So these questions include, how can we scale tools and techniques from smaller environments like single computers to the whole web? And what's the role of services in this? There are at least 2 questions about services. First of all, the question is, how can services benefit from tapping into the whole web of data and all the information that it has? And the second question is, how can services, well, are services just a problem or can they also be part of the solution? So can services actually help us to make big data manageable? That's the question. And, well, actually, I forgot to say initially, there is also a wiki page that's linked right here on this slide. It's actually, small mistake here, not this wiki page, but the community input wiki page that is linked from this one. There's another place where we appreciate your inputs, and then eventually, after some time of discussion, we will synthesize it into this page that is linked here, and finally into the communique of the whole Ontology Summit. Okay, it's slide 4 now, about the layout of this session. So after I'm over with this intro, the first talk will be given by Till Mosakowski. For each speaker will speak for around 25 minutes. While these presentations are going on, do feel free to post questions into the chat, and at the very latest, we will try to address them afterwards. So Till will speak about scaling a suite of tools for ontologies from reasoning in the small to the big web. And there are 2 tools he will specifically talk about. It is HETS, the heterogeneous tool set, which used to be, well, desktop-based and single machine-oriented and is now being scaled up. And one aspect of this scaling up is the web front-end onto hub, front-end to ontology tools and to managing ontology repositories. Then the second speaker will be Chris Welty of IBM Research, speaking about the probably well-known IBM Watson engine, a natural language question answering engine, that is powered by big data from the web, as for example Wikipedia. And well, it's not quite the usual way of ontological reasoning that's being employed here, but rather, well, intelligent, scalable, and super efficient ways of matching keywords, for example. And the third presentation will be by Alan Rector, who is also my co-champion in track B, about it's a review of OWL and alternatives for modeling for knowledge engineering. And these are being reviewed from the perspective of engineering knowledge-rich systems, which we will increasingly need when the more data the web has to offer and the more ambitious services we want to provide. So with this, my introduction is over, and I'd like to pass over to Till Masakowski. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Christoph, for inviting me. Thanks for the introduction. I must warn you that my experiences with HETS and OntoHub will be about the attempt to scale actually these tools to the semantic web, but we are not yet in the area of big data, so I must disappoint you. I cannot tell you anything about big data, and probably the other two speakers are more competent in this area. Slide two, just to briefly recall what ontologies could mean for the semantic web. Slide three, here you have the current semantic web layer cake. You see their URIs or IRIs at the bottom, which are quite important, and XML, RDF at the data level, and then for the ontologies, RDFS, OWL, Sparkle for querying, RIF for rules, so changing the A boxes in some way, and there's also RuleML. And then you have logic, proof, trust above that. On slide four, this is some very old picture by Tim Berners-Lee that was before the introduction of OWL. Actually, he also had even more expressive logics like first or higher order logic or non-classical logics in mind. I found it quite interesting. This is about 14 years old. So slide five, what I see as challenges for the semantic web is the diversity of both data and ontology languages that we have there. And beyond those that I just have mentioned, there is also entity relationship diagrams, OBO, there is UML, especially UML class diagrams are often used for ontological modeling. There's SCoS, F-Logic, Common Logic, SPVR. And so this diversity is, of course, a challenge. And then there is ontology matching and alignment, which is an active field of study. And it's, of course, if you have multiple ontologies, covering one and the same domain or partially overlapping ontologies, then the question of alignment is very important. And I want to stress that ontology alignment can also be necessary across different ontology languages. And with OntoApp and HETS, we have also a notion of merging and combination of along alignments. I think that's also important. If you have several ontologies for a certain domain, you have aligned them, then you might want also to produce a new ontology where everything is integrated in some meaningful way. But often, of course, in the case of large amounts of data, the data and the ontologies also have to remain distributed because it's there is no other way. And then you have the important field of ontology-based data access, or recently called data management. Slide six. This is about OntoIOP, So slide 7, onto IOP is a standardization initiative that has seen the need for a unifying meta language, which is not yet another ontology language, but basically a meta language covering the diversity of ontology languages and data languages, translations between these, and also different operations on ontologies. And current standards like the OWL API or the Alignment API only cover parts of this. And therefore, we have founded this Ontology Modeling and Specification Integration and Interoperability Initiative. Slide 8, it started as an ISO standard, but is now continued as an OMG standard. The OMG request for proposals has been recently issued in December, and the answers are due in 1 year. And there are a number of experts participating, and we have the distributed ontology language as one answer to this request for proposals. Slide 9, here you can see an initial logic graph that we could use for onto IOP, and you see logics of varying expressiveness, starting with OWL fragments like EL and RDF and OBO, and ranging over first order logic, common logic, up to higher order logic. For example, Alan Bundy even has ontologies of physics formulated in higher order logic and work about ontology repair and so on. Slide 10. So now that's the main topic of this talk, the tools. What are the tools for onto IOP or DOL? First, there's the heterogeneous tool set, which is an analysis, so parsing and analysis tool, and also a proof management tool. So it does the job that usual theorem provers or classifiers like Palette and Fact do, or consistency checkers, is an ontology consistent. But it scales this to the heterogeneous level. We're on slide 11. Sorry, I didn't say that. So it scales these tools to a heterogeneous level. That means that you can also use these tools in a heterogeneous environment where you have different languages and ontologies formulated in different languages and a kind of distributed network of such ontologies. And that's an important point, because it's unrealistic to assume that everything is homogeneous. Slide 12, we have the Onto web portal and repository. This is now, as Christoph already said, it's based on HETS. HETS is a backend for Onto Hub, but Onto Hub tries to scale this to the web and also provide a web 2.0 interface, which is much nicer for users. And Onto Hub speaks various languages like this distributed ontology language DOL, but also RDF and OWL and Common Logic. Also recently, MOF has been added from the UML world. UML class diagrams will follow soon. And what OntoHub also builds on is Git. And the name OntoHub is also has been inspired by GitHub. If you know GitHub, so it's a very successful platform with an exponential growth, and this success is mainly due to the decentralized nature of Git. So Git is a repository like Subversion is, but Git is really decentralized, which was necessary for the Linux kernel, and Linus Torvalds has created Git with this in mind, that thousands of different developers are working on one project. And therefore, it's easy to branch and easy to get set up networks of repositories. And therefore, we have taken Git as a backend that is tightly integrated into OntoHub. And Git can be used for ontology maintenance and version control. And I think that this will be an important step for scalability. Because currently the practice is that everyone sets up a small server and puts some ontologies there. But there is no real repository backend. And Git, as the success of GitHub illustrates, is the right tool to do this. Okay, so that was slide 12. Now slide 13. What are the semantic web challenges for both OntoHub and HETS? I have listed three. One is the move from identifiers to IRIs, linked data compliance, and large amounts of data. I will treat these three individually now on the next slides, slide 14. So the move from identifiers to IRIs and queries was quite a lot of work. HETS and OntoHub use them now everywhere, but the problem is that some of the involved ontology languages do not necessarily do so. For example, Common Logic has not used IRIs. We have now influenced the Common Logic group, and for example, the most important repository there, Colora, now uses IRIs, and that's a good prerequisite for integrating this into OntoHub. Of course, OWL is based on URLs anyway, so that there's no problem. And the problem is that there is no well-established module system for IRIs. So OWL provides only imports, no complex module, and other module systems don't provide IRIs. So our solution is to use URIs or IRIs from MMT. MMT is a scalable module system, has a formal semantics that is foundationally uncommitted, so it's basically agnostic, but also web scalable. So it's semantically founded, but still modular and web scalable. And the MMT IRIs have a form doc question mark mod, where document doc is a document containing some ontology, and mod is a module within that document, or it's also doc mod sim with two question marks. These question mark notation may be sound unusual, but it's compliant with web standards, and yeah, it's a recent notation that has been invented, and there has been a lot of work on basing this also with the formal semantics, like OWL also has. And with this solution, I think we have the necessary means for web scalability. So that means that if you have a complex document with several modules, in OWL you can't have that. You only have one ontology per document, but for example, in Common Logic, you can have several documents, and then you can use this notation to access individual modules. And finally, queries are a useful abbreviation mechanism that's taken from RDFA. There's the question what MMT does stand for. That's a good question. Actually, I don't know. It's a scalable. I know it's a scalable module system. That there's also a paper on that with that.
This is Christoph Lange. I'll post a link to the MMT homepage. It's a module system for mathematical theories. So it's originally from mathematical and formal logic, but it also turned out to be applicable to ontologies as we know them.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Christoph, for this clarification. Slide 15, linked data compliance. So OntoHub is somehow linked data compliant, and probably it can be improved, but at some URL, I forget to check whether this actually works. maybe you have to correct it. At some URL, you can actually obtain both useful description of ontology in HTML as well as the raw file, depending on whether you have a MIME type where you have HTML or plain text, or you can also have XML. So that at one and the same URL, you can get different formats. That's not new. That's long known. But I have looked at several ontology repositories, and I didn't find anyone actually implementing that. The correct URL that you can try is in the chat. Sorry, I forgot. Instead of vector, it needs to be vector space. Okay, and then onto hub, we have actually a mirror mechanism that you can mirror external ontologies, and a mapping mechanism, so a URL catalog mechanism, in order to handle the problem that ontology repositories generally are not linked data compliant and still work in a linked data compliant environment. Okay, slide 16. Large amounts of data. So we are facing these problems. We are not experts in this problem, so we are we appreciate any help there. So one thing is that modularity helps a lot. So Hetz and OntoHub support a rich module language, namely DOL, and they can also display module graphs. But these graphs have to be split into subgraphs and in order to be manageable. I show you some pictures on the next slides. DOL supports also extraction of modules that has been long studied in the ontology world. If you have a very large ontology like SNOMED with more than 100,000 concepts, you can extract a module with a few concepts only and be sure that it logically still says the same on this restricted set of symbols as the whole ontology. We have also a PhD thesis about the reuse of logical theories, so that searches for logical commonalities among theories, so that you can a posteriori discover potential sharing among ontologies and use this for a useful splitting. And then an important point is service decomposition that we plan. It's not actually done yet. But we plan to set up a server farm for parsing, analysis, and proving in the individual ontologies so that this can be decoupled. And actually, we have already, OntoHub has already integrated other services, but Christoph explicitly asked for the problems with services. So one problem with services is, so we have, for example, an interface to BioPortal. BioPortal is also an important repository for ontologies, the most important one, I would say. And we have developed an interface, but the problem is that there are various BioPortal instances online and each running different versions of the interface, and then we need to support all those versions, so that's a lot of work. And we have also integrated another service like OOPS. OOPS is an ontology evaluation service. And there is also the problem that sometimes we had problems connecting and so on. So with other services, we also had the problem that service descriptions the service API changes without notice and so on. So there are solutions to these problems, of course, and but the problem is actually to use these solutions. Okay, so the OntoHub database is still PostgreSQL, so there's not big data ready. But maybe we can do something there, but currently we don't feel the need. Just on slide 17, about these large module graphs. Here you have two large module graphs displayed in Hetz. The first one is the libraries of Hetz. The second one is Colore, the CommonLogic repository, and it's actually only part of Colore. And the problem is that these graphs are just too large to be looked at. So what Hetz actually can do is split these graphs into subgraphs. And OntoHub on slide 18, you can see the OntoHub page with a BioPortal mirror. That's the repository there. And within the BioPortal mirror, you have an ontology IAO main. And so some medical ontology. And the important thing is that you now have a module graph there. So showing the imports, what this ontology imports, and then our current solution is just to let the user vary the depth of the diameter of the graph that is actually displayed in order to make this manageable. Okay, then slide 19. So future work will be more tools for splitting ontologies, and also when feeding this into proving tools, it's very relevant to have tools for selecting the relevant axioms. So the psych people have some experience with that. If you have ontologies with millions of axioms, then it's actually unfeasible to send them to a prover because the prover doesn't have the database technology to load these axioms into its internal working space. And then this question of selecting relevant parts gets very important, and there are some techniques for that. And then there's the question whether we really should use NoSQL databases for ontology repositories in order to scale them, but currently I think that's not necessary. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Till. This was a lot of inspiration and a good collection of tools, not just those that you presented, but also a number of tools this is based on and tools that have been plugged in as OOPS. So I'm sure we'll have a lot of productive discussion about this afterwards. By the way, let me interrupt for a technical announcement. If there are still people in this phone call who are not yet in the chat room, could you please look up the session page on the Ontology Summit wiki website? It has instructions on how to join a chat room where, all of the participants should be, and where you can ask questions, and where we will have a lot of our discussion that comes off after the actual presentations. Okay, I will pass the token on to Chris Welty, our next speaker from IBM Research, presenting semantic technology in Watson. Chris, the stage is yours.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to go to slide 2. I'm going to assume most of you, I don't really have time to go into deeply into what Watson is and what Jeopardy is, so I'm going to assume a lot of you already are familiar with it. Basically, Watson is a question answering system that answers natural language questions, gives very precise answers, precise here meaning that a human would consider it to be an answer to a question as opposed to returning a document. And it was tested in a live match against human experts at trivia, and it did quite well. On slide 3, sorry, some of my animations didn't come across in the PDF version. Interesting aspect of Jeopardy is that even though it's a game show, I think a lot of Americans who are familiar with it think of it as a smart show, not kind of a stupid show like most game shows. And the questions they ask really range to a wide variety of topics and require quite a bit of knowledge on the part of the human participants. And that's what makes the show really hard to play from a human perspective. You need to know a lot about a lot of different things. There's 4 examples of questions there. That one, you need to know something about interior decorating. The other is a literature question, a biology question, and a history question. So, the range of things it can ask about is quite open. For machines, however, the problem is not knowing the answers to the questions. We know that in the case of Jeopardy, Watson had the answer somewhere, and its knowledge, its corpus of knowledge to over 99% of the questions. The problem was understanding the questions. And that's the real challenge for machines. So what I'm going to talk about, we can skip slide four. What I'm going to talk about today is how different kinds of semantic information, the primary source of information that Watson uses for answers is in text, but we did use semantic technology, we did use linked data, we did use information that was represented in a semantic form to help us, to help the machine understand when an answer was right, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. In order to understand the impact that this technology had on Watson, it's important to understand the metric. So in slide five, showing you the metric that we used to rate changes we made we would take different combinations of algorithms and see how they performed. We would add new algorithms, we would add new data, and we would test against some baseline version of our system to see if the additions we made actually led to an improvement. And how do you know you got an improvement? You have to have some way of measuring it. And since any change we make to the system ends up with some new questions being correct and some previously correct questions becoming wrong, we need to know that there was a net positive gain in order to have belief that a change we made really was beneficial. So the metric we chose is shown here. On the x-axis, you see the percent of the questions that are answered. In Jeopardy, you don't have to answer every question, but you need to answer enough to win. And so there's sort of an optimization happening there between your confidence in your answer and the need to answer a lot of questions correctly. The dots, on the y-axis is your precision for the questions that you answered. So the dots now are plotted. Every human who ever won a game of Jeopardy is a dot there, and you can see the sort of center of that cloud is at about 50% answered and 90% precision. That means the average winner of a game of Jeopardy answered half of the questions in the game and got 90% of the questions that they tried to answer correct. The brown line at the bottom is a plot of our system performance from the system that we had before we started the Jeopardy challenge. And that was plotted by basically taking a set of 5,000 questions, having Watson compute the answer to those questions, and then sort them by their confidence. And as we move from the right to the left on the x-axis, we're removing questions to get from 100% answer to 90%. The 10% of the questions we remove are the questions that the system had its lowest confidence in. So you would expect, if the confidence estimation is meaningful, you would expect that brown line to go up with a slope of -1 from the sort of bottom right of the graph to the top left. And that brown line doesn't, obviously, showing that our system wasn't able to estimate its confidence reliably, and it wasn't able to answer a lot of questions correctly. And that was the system we started with. It was pretty much a IR kind of system. So if you go now to the next slide, slide six, it's basically dramatizing the big gap between the system we started with and human performance, human expert performance at this sort of high-speed trivia question-answering challenge. And then on slide seven is sort of the incremental progress that our system made through careful engineering and good architecture. The first real test of the system is that orange line that was from December 2007. The important thing of that line is not that we doubled our overall performance at 100% answered from the system we began with, but more important than that is that the confidence is actually starting to show signal. You can see that that orange line, if you look, scan from right to left, is going up. So as we remove lower confidence answers, we tend to be removing wrong answers. We chose as a single metric to represent, whenever we needed one number to represent the performance of the system, we chose the precision at 70% answered. So this is nice because it reflects both the number of questions that we answer correctly as well as our precision. And so the, as you can see with steady improvement in the system, we were answering 70% of Jeopardy questions with 87% precision. So that's comparable to human expert performance of the task. Okay, so how does this system work? If we go to slide 8, the most important thing to understand about Watson is what we do and don't do in order to answer questions. What we do is search for potentially relevant passages in a background corpus that contains factual documents like Wikipedia, other encyclopedias like Britannica and World Book. It also includes New York Times, going back to the beginning of that newspaper, Time Magazine going back to 1920, a lot of song lyrics, works of Shakespeare, and the Bible. Based on our domain analysis, and the Jeopardy show tends to ask questions about those things as well. So we're searching that corpus for passages that seem to be related to the answer using some of the more advanced information retrieval type of techniques. And then once we get a set of passages back, the vast majority of those passages do not answer the question. And the big challenge, the sort of real meat of what Watson does that's innovative, is trying to understand for all of those candidate passages that were returned by search, which ones answer the question and how well they seem, how confident the machine is that it does. So that matching of a retrieved passage to a question is the core operation that Watson is doing. It gets its answers from text. What we don't do is we don't translate the question into logic, and we don't translate our background corpus into logic and use some kind of reasoning to match them. So on slide 9, just a little bit, digging a little bit deeper into this idea of matching passages, if you're using, the reason web search doesn't work as a question answering technology by itself is that it uses primarily extensions to the idea of keyword matching. And if you're doing just keyword matching, you're going to get a lot of junk. This is a real Jeopardy question. In May 1898, Portugal celebrated the 400th anniversary of this explorer's arrival in India. The answer is Vasco da Gama. And this passage, which we made up just to highlight sort of the places where keyword search can fail, it has a lot of the keywords in the question, but no one would ever think that that answers the question. Certainly no person who understands English would ever think that that answers the question. However, from a keyword perspective, it does seem to have a lot of evidence. On slide 10, we have the same question, and now with a real passage that was in Wikipedia, at least in 2011 when we made this slide. This is a passage that answers the question. It's what we would call a justifying passage. So it answers the question. If you as humans knew that Cathay Beach was in India, you would understand that this answers the question as well. So it unfortunately only matches the question on one keyword. So how are we going to know? What kind of algorithms do you need in order to know that this passage matches the question? So, or answers the question. First of all, you need to understand that 1898 is 400 years after 1498. So you need to be able to understand that some date math is required to figure out what date should appear in the answer. You need to understand that arrival in and landed in, at least in the context of these two passages, are saying the same thing. You need to know that Cappin Beach is in India, and you need to know that Vasco da Gama was an explorer. So if you could gather that kind of evidence and put it all together, you would at least have some indication that this passage answers the question. And the interesting thing here is that we use, what I'm going to sort of focus on is that we do use information stored in databases, in the semantic web and linked data, not to find the answer to this question, but rather to give some of these little pieces of evidence. So geonames can tell us that Cappin Beach is in India. I need to know that in order to match that bit of evidence here in these two passages to each other. Geonames doesn't give me the answer to the question, however, but it helps me to gather evidence to know that this sentence answers the question. And I can also find in various structured sources on the linked data cloud evidence that Vasco da Gama is an explorer. And those are two of the key places where structured information was used to help us understand when a passage answers a question. So on slide 11, we have the basic architecture of Watson. I'm not going to go into it into too much detail. Just with respect to what I've said so far, when a question comes in, we analyze it, we parse it, we recognize named entities in it, and we generate a search, and that search is responsible for retrieving the candidate passages that we're then going to try to match to the question to see if they look like their answers. And the real meat, the real heavy lifting that Watson does is in that hypothesis and evidence scoring. This is when it takes those candidate passages that were retrieved by search and tries to figure out the degree to which they answer the question using about 150 different algorithms for making that match. And then in the final step there, final confidence merging and ranking, we use various learned models to try to determine which pieces of evidence were the most important and compare different answers and see which ones are the strongest. So in that final step there, that's where we synthesize all of the evidence that was gathered for each answer, compare sort of the evidence between across answers, and come up with a final confidence in what we think the best answer is. On slide 12, I'm now showing you the architecture annotated with all the places in the architecture where we used information from linked data, primarily information from mostly manually created but not almost never created by us sources in order to help do some processing at that step in the pipeline. So on the top left, you can see we do some relation detection based on an idea called distance supervision, in which we can sort of use evidence from large databases that have a lot of accurate information, like IMDb has lots of actor movie tuples for actors that appeared in movies. And we can try to find those, you know, if Leonardo DiCaprio is known by IMDb to be an actor in the movie Titanic, we can find places where in text where both of those names are mentioned and gather evidence about the way we in language talk about the acted in movie relation. In the second one, answer typing, I'll be going a little bit more deeply into that here, so I'll skip it for the moment. Answer includes, very important to understand that aliases are very common in our language, and that you don't want to give as an answer to a question that mentions one thing, a variant of that thing's name. So the question here, this is a real example in which we took this question in 2003, Big Blue acquired this company, and we answered IBM. That's answers like that need to be removed from our answer list, and we maintain mainly through evidence, through data gathered from DBpedia, lists of aliases of things, and we have some evidence knowing when one thing is the nickname of another. We do some spatial reasoning, but reasoning is not an appropriate word to use there. We use information from geographic databases to help understand when east and west and north and south are used with respect to something mentioned in a question and an answer. We use, again, reasoning is a pretty loose term here for temporal. We use very associative data that's mined from structured sources to help us understand when time is relevant. I don't really have time to go into those things. Evidence diffusion is also something I don't have time to talk about, but helps us to use information between instances in a graph-like form to understand when evidence for one answer may also be evidence for another answer. We use I don't really have enough time to go into details on any of these other things. So let me just skip to slide 14. So typing is one of the best ways, one of the most productive ways in which taxonomic information stored in large taxonomies like Wikipedia, Yago, WordNet, Freebase, DBpedia, these sources have lots of information about the sort of taxonomic structure of words that we use in language. And those similar words are used in questions to identify the type of thing that we expect the answer to be. And the type can often be used to discern when an answer is obvious nonsense. Remember, the machine is not working so much on trying to figure out what the answer is. The machine is working on understanding the question. And so it doesn't really know offhand that telescope is not the answer to a question in which you're looking for a planet. So without some support from sources that know what typing is, we have a hard time telling that telescope is a silly answer to the question. So on slide 15, you know, if you think that this is easy and we should just be able to use something like, Dolce or some other very simple ontology, the problem that we have is that if you take 20,000 questions from Jeopardy and record the distribution, the frequency of the different types that are being asked for. So in the previous slide, on slide 14, I was showing you a question about astronomy in which the type of thing being asked for was a planet. It's fairly easy to detect in language what the type being asked for is, but it's actually very hard to account before you see a question. It's very hard to account for what types of things are going to get asked for. And so the distribution of different types being asked for in Jeopardy had a very, very long tail. And the top 200 types being asked for still don't cover half of the number of questions. So you really need to be flexible. You need to understand that language is extremely flexible. Almost any word can be used either colorfully or creatively or very specifically as a type of something. So on slide 16, we developed the framework we called type coercion for dealing with this problem. And the idea is we didn't a priori classify anything. Any entity that we knew about did not a priori have a set of types that it belonged to, but rather, given a question and an answer that came out of a passage that had some evidence as answering the question, we would try to coerce that answer into the type that the question wanted and score basically how hard it was to coerce that or how easy it was to believe that, how much evidence we found that an answer is of the right type. And so in this blue box on slide 16, there are the four steps, and the most important thing to understand about utilizing any kind of structured information for natural language problem processing is that the hardest thing about doing that is crossing over from language in which you have names of things and a very high variability when it comes to naming things. Crossing that into the identifiers that tend to be stricter and tend to be much more precise that structured sources use, like URIs, for example. And so if I have a string coming in from as a candidate answer to a question, and the string is just extracted from the passage that was retrieved that we're trying to match to the question. And here we have an example where the string that was extracted from text is JFK. And now we're trying to look that up in some structured source. We call this step entity disambiguation and matching, and it is the most difficult step. It sounds trivial, but it is the hardest part of this entire process. Being able to do this well with a large coverage knowledge base is extremely difficult because you have two main problems. And on slide, what is that, 17, the problem one is that each entity that we may know about is going to have multiple names because they're referred to in multiple ways. And the second problem is that the same string may be the name of multiple things. And if you look in DBpedia, the average number of things that have, you know, given a string, how many things have it as a name or as a label, is about 5. So the average string that we extract from text as the name of something has on average 5 possible URIs that use it as a name. So the EDM problem is trying to basically disambiguate that. If we move back to slide 16, the goal of this EDM step is to give it a name of something to return its identifier. Once we have the identifier, most of it is easy. We can then retrieve the types for this identifier. That's what structured sources are pretty good at. We also have another problem, very similar to the EDM problem, in which a string comes in that is the type word from the question, and we need to try to find out what type in the structured source, what class you might call it, what tag, what Wikipedia category, that corresponds to that type word. So if the type word is facility, I'm trying to retrieve some identifier for some type in some structured source that corresponds to it. WordNet, in this example, happens to have something named facility. And now once I have a type that matches the question type and a type that matches a candidate answer's type, I can then try to match them using algorithms that probably most people know. And if they match, like if one is a subclass of the other in a taxonomy that we trust, we'll get a match score. And each one of these four steps produces a confidence. In particular, the first two steps, the EDM and PDM steps, they produce a confidence that the string matches this identifier. And the final confidence that a given answer is of a given type from a question is just the product of those four scores. So I'm going to skip now. There's a little bit more detail on what I just described in the next several slides, but I'll skip to slide 24 and just start wrapping up here. And within Watson, the Jeopardy version of Watson, there were 14 different algorithms that implemented the four steps, 14 different sources that implemented those four steps. They include DBpedia and Yago, Freebase, IMDb, WordNet, Wikipedia categories, lists that we mined from the web, just people like to make lists of things, and a variety of other sources. And on and slide 25, as you can see on slide 25, so slide 26 has things being telling jokes when everyone's muted, so I'm just going to assume everyone was laughing. On slide 25 is supposed to be a picture of the impact that these TICOR sources had on Jeopardy, and basically it was 10% precision at 70. So if you remember back at the beginning, I described the metric we used. If you pull all the structured sources out of Watson, we lose about 10% precision at the at that critical 70% answered. So that's pretty big impact when you're dealing with a system that gets 87% precision at that number of questions answered. On slide 26, I'll just reiterate again, there's more detail on the slide than I have time to go into, but the biggest problem with harnessing any kind of knowledge for natural language processing is trying to match the way things in the structured source are referred to in language to those things in the source. And another big problem in implementing that is that no source is ever perfect. You know, we're doing medicine now, we're trying to use medical sources, and we find that they are really very, very, very incomplete when it comes to the kinds of knowledge that people expect to be there. But we have to account for that. We don't build our own knowledge bases. Part of our system is understanding just how complete or incomplete any particular source is for providing a kind of evidence to the system. And it's really important to understand that that's a major factor in being able to effectively harness these kinds of resources. Okay, I will stop there.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much for this presentation. The last slide, we should keep this in mind for further discussion. Before we'll listen to one more presentation given by Alan Rector, now leading us back to more, let's say, traditional modes of reasoning, OWL, UML, and frames, and what they are usable for when engineering knowledge-rich systems. Please, Alan.
Thank you. This is being presented on slightly short notice, and in some ways might fit into one of the earlier sections. It's a response to a series of questions that get asked repeatedly about both OWL, UML. It could equally be talking about RDFS, actually, but the relationship between OWL and more standard or more familiar to people methods of object-oriented or database modeling. And it is partially a plea to recognize that there really are some large differences and to think about ways that we might bridge some of those differences. So can we move on to slide 2, please? It also relates, so this is the first question is, we're working with people to develop ontologies or people who have large ontologies, and they suddenly want to use them to develop UML schemas based on them. There are several other questions in terms of the expressiveness of OWL, which people run up against, of which, how do I say may in OWL comes up all the time. A lot of the information that people want to represent attached to their ontology is contingent or particular. It's not things that are universally true. And there's the general question of how is it so hard to get people to switch. So if we can go on to the next slide, just for the background, although much of what I do, I really work in medium data rather than big data. They're very big ontologies. They're medical ontologies. They're anything from 10 to a half million or a million classes. The actual data normally runs into tens of millions of instances and is never held in OWL. Is almost always held in a database or an RDF or triple store or something else, but it's certainly not held as an OWL A box. The thing I absolutely have to have in this, the vocabularies I'm working with are combinatorial. And if you don't build them compositionally or combinatorially, they become enormous. Some of people may have noticed in the New York Times and other places articles on the latest release of the new International Classification of Diseases, the American Clinical Modification version, which if you live in the U.S. is the thing which is going to be used to determine the amount that your insurance company pays your doctor and hospital. And the Australians did it first, and this CM version, the international version from WHO, has about 20,000 concepts in it. The CM version has more than 10 times that. And many of them are enormous. There are quite a number of codes for accidents involving ORCA. There are over 500 codes for injuries and accidents involving bicycles, including things like injury to somebody on a pedal-driven two- or three-wheeled vehicle in a collision with an animal-driven vehicle on a public road in the course of business. I forget, there's a fourth clause attached to it. Clearly, these are not things you really want to specify in great detail. Also, you end up with things blowing up because there are particular interests. The number of things that can happen to members of spacecraft ground crew are not enormously different from those that can happen in other cases, but there are several hundred, maybe 1,000 codes for accidents to people in spacecraft because NASA maintains a superb medical record system for everybody who touches the space system in any way whatsoever, and argued very strongly to get them in there. An interesting trade-off is that there are large number of codes for accidents for elk because the committee process in the room when this was taken on, the Swedes argued, well, if you were going to have the spacecraft, we're going to have the elk. Actually, the total number of extra codes you actually need is one for an elk and a few for special substances that are involved in spacecraft and a few for special roles. But the total increase in number of codes is enormous. So this composition is important. And then they're too big to keep track of the hierarchy. These multiple hierarchies just can't be maintained manually. And then we use them for the obvious thing, for validation and error detection, the basis of generating natural language labels. And of course, I use OWL because it's a standard. So if we can go on to the next slide. And one of the questions really is, we use this word ontology, but it slipped around. And one of the things that actually seems to me to be a problem, particularly because we have a lot of discussions in the biomedical area with the people from the Barry Smith's community and the Oboe community, of just what should be in an ontology is, where are the boundaries? And it seems quite odd to me that some of the distinctions that we made early on have got lost. And do we really, when we say, a lot of the time it seems to be, as we're talking currently about ontology, that we really mean all of knowledge representation. And that's a little bit the way I think actually the Ontolog Forum is going. And I'd very much like to think about a narrower sense, if we can move on to the next slide, to think about the ontology as part of a background knowledge base, and then that's separate from the information model. And that's an important distinction, and that's part of what this talk will be about. The other one I want to talk about in particular is the distinction between axiom-based and template-based representations, which the logic programming community manages to bridge this. One of the reasons the OWL community often finds itself hard to work with other things is it doesn't terribly well. Related to this is an issue which keeps coming up of people not understanding the distinction in OWL between class expressions and queries. Because for many things in OWL, you can query it simply by forming a class expression. The difference between when do you need to, can you form a class expression and when can you need a Sparkle or a Sparkle 1.1, which is what Sparkle OWL has become, and when you need the OWL entailment regime are questions that are not well laid out, and certainly there seems to be a lot of confusion. I'm certainly not going to be able to cover all of that, but I hope to at least raise it as an issue today. And finally, related to this, and particularly related to the question about the knowledge base versus the information model, is models of the domain we're talking about, for me, biomedicine, and models of the information about that domain. What is in a medical record? What is in a biomedical database? So I look the picture, if we can move on to the next slide, which has a diagram on it, slide six. I look at this as something much closer to the sort of architectures which we talked about a long time ago when I came into this field in the mid-80s and early 90s, updated a bit, but a background knowledge base in which, in our modern terms, there's a central core, which I would describe as the ontology, the universal knowledge, the things that are the definitions. What is there, as opposed to all the other knowledge that we have about it? Then the information model or schema, which is how information about that is actually held for some practical purpose. And these things can be actually quite different. Next slide. So if we take the ontology for this talk, I don't know how much I really need to say this, but that phrase that we hear all the time that Tom Gruber introduced of the conceptualization of a domain turns out to be a wonderful sounding phrase until you try and cash out exactly what it means. And then it suddenly turns out to mean either everything in knowledge representation or we're not quite sure what. Going back to the original philosophical meaning, which is where you get a lot of the links for the Barry Smith and Co., it's what exists. And the natural sense to me about what that would mean for information systems is what is necessarily true in this information system by definition. What are the definitions? What are the things that are relevant to this particular information system? And to a good first approximation, this is a subset, at least, of the OWL T-box. Very little of the OWL A-box really fits into this. You can argue that things like an A-box about the countries in a geography system might fit into it, but most of the things that we use in biomedicine don't really naturally fit into this. We can move on to the next slide. I'm having trouble moving on. So this other example is between the universal knowledge, the ontology in the narrow sense, and the broader background knowledge, which we've never found a good word that everybody can agree on. When I say particular is the classical Aristotelian word, but this drives the medics nuts because they think it means something else. Contingent drives some of the logicians nuts because they think it means something else. I don't really have a word for non-universal, but the difference is between things like pneumonia is a lung disease. Pneumonia means a certain kind of inflammation of the lung. It happens to be a fact of the world that it can be caused by bacteria. It can also be caused by viruses, by various noxious chemicals, by asbestos, by all sorts of other things. Again, rashes are located on the skin, or if you want to be more technical, the epithelium, But meningitis may cause a rash. That's the sort of information you find in textbooks much more commonly. The definition is I would say is the ontology. You get into a slightly trickier area with penicillin as an antibiotic. Penicillin, perhaps you could argue, really we ought to just call it a beta-lactam chemical, but it's so primarily an antibiotic, that tends to fit on that side. But the ways of representing these forms of information are different. So, next slide. So that ontology, narrow sense, are all things that are, if you have them in first order logic, they begin with universal quantifiers. They're statements about everything. So it's either B is a subclass of A, for all X, B is a kind of X. I won't go through these in detail. These all look familiar. Most of the contingent knowledge is stuff that begins with there exists. There exist pneumonias which are caused by bacteria. There exist rashes that are caused by meningitis. And technically, these are the subset that we use for OWL. Representing these is not natural. And I'm going to suggest some ways we might work around it, but it represents a large amount of the information, and the people, my users, the sorts of people who are trying to put together, quote, ontologies for use in particular fields, this isn't a particularly natural division for them. And we often need ways of their building knowledge bases that include both. The other distinction, which roughly parallels this, is between the sorts of representation systems that are based on axioms and those that are based on templates. And it's taken a long time for some of us to begin to understand that this really is a fairly fundamental difference. Axioms are things from which we draw inferences. Templates are data structures. And the sort of practical differences is the axioms are necessary truth statement. The templates may well be include all sorts of contingent things. But the most important thing is partway down. The axioms always restrict that whenever we put in an axiom, the number of models that we can are consistent with the set of axioms goes down. Whereas templates permit. You can't say something in a template system until you put in a slot or a field or data. And the way you represent things in template systems is to add to them. And things in UML, so there are arguments about whether you should put in all of your fields at the top and then restrict them as you go down or build them up. But fundamentally, the process is one of permission. Whereas fundamentally in axioms, the process is one of constraints. The other thing which is very important is axiom systems are global and therefore in some ways much harder to debug. Most template systems are local in the sense that what you say about a template is specific to the particular item and its descendants, but can't have effects over completely someplace else. Whereas an axiom that you put in can have an effect a long way away, as anybody who's ever had to debug a strange result in an OWL ontology will be acutely aware. Likewise, in axioms, we can have underspecified existence. We can say John has a sister. In most template systems, we have to, as in logic programming, scholemize it and say John's sister is put in a dummy variable. Classification, we can infer classification with axioms. We can't in templates. We have to make them explicit. And a big difference to the people who are building them is that axiom systems are built in two steps. First, you assert the axioms, and then you run some sort of reasoner. most template systems are built in one step. You build it, and what you see is what you get. Moving on to the next slide, again, a similar set of dichotomies. The domain knowledge is about the domain, and it's the information knowledge about the information. And the most obvious distinction of this is in the domain, things can be true, false, or uncertain. In the information model, they tend to be present or missing. In the domain knowledge, we infer existence. It makes no sense to talk about a body that doesn't have a temperature, but it makes perfect sense to talk about a form, a missing entry for body temperature on a medical record. Most domain models are open just intrinsically. Our knowledge of biology is open. We just don't know everything. Most information models are technically closed. That may be desirable or not. And most of the time we're trying in the domain model to represent our understanding of the domain. In the information model, we're trying to construct something to allow us to do something specific. And we want the two to be parallel. The thing that's confusing is that one of the things that we've discovered is that it's much easier to build these things if you get a reasonable parallelism between the information model and the domain model. But then it's very easy accidentally to get things which really only make sense in the information space into the domain model and vice versa. And the variables when we're asking questions in the domain model range over domain entities. Variables in the information model range over the symbols. And that's the key difference between the DL class statement and the query. The DL class statement is ranging over a representation of the domain. The query is actually the variables are ranging over the symbols in the representation of that domain. Next. So these things tend to fall into a two-way graph that we can talk about axioms and most logics, conceptual graphs run across these things and are used both as templates and as axioms. The canonical graph mechanism, which isn't emphasized as much in conceptual graphs these days, is very much a template mechanism. Grail was an unusual language in that basically it had axioms, but it also had this notion of sanctions, because one of the things that templates make it easy to do, which is very hard to do in OWL, is answer the question, which properties apply to this class or this individual? A trivial thing to do in most database representation languages, in frames, in most of the other representation we have. In logic-based representations, what you actually can ask is which things don't apply, and then subtract, which is a very different kind of thing. Next slide. I want to keep moving. So the question is, how might we reconcile these things cheaply? And this presentation is very much, on the one hand, I applaud all of the efforts which are going into more advanced representations which potentially actually have the power of both of these kinds of approaches. But at the moment, what I've got is OWL and UML and people wanting to get back and forth between them, and OWL and frames. And what sorts of hybrid representations might we produce that would make it easier? And one reason for looking at this, again, is because we can think of several ways of doing it, and actually the way we do it in the applications that we're building commercially is not the way I'm going to describe here. It's a rather more ad hoc mechanism, frankly. But this the mechanism that I'm going to describe here is chosen particularly to illustrate this distinction between template and axiom. So next slide. So what I'm going to suggest is that actually if we look at what UML actually, if we take our question, what causes pneumonia, a natural way of representing this in UML, and you could do the same in RDF schema or in frames, is to think of disorder linked by, to an agent by an association. And one of the things about actually that people often ignore in UML is that every association is actually a class or has a class associated with it. And notice that in the UML, a couple of things which are quite different from the OWL, that we can have any agent, as we've managed to get the notion here that every disorder must have an agent. An agent can be attached to any number of disorders. It's causal. This is also, however, reciprocal. If disorders cause agents, then agents must be things which, at least under some circumstances, might cause disorders. And the notion of multiplicity is slightly different from what it is in an axiom system. The obvious OWL means something really quite different. If we take a property caused by, which has a domain disorder and a range agent, and a class disorder, which is a subclass of things caused by agent, the first thing about that is that's a unidirectional statement. It says nothing about agents. It only says things about disorders. It also says that an agent will be inferred to exist whenever a disorder exists. Whereas if I don't have an agent for a disorder in the UML, I'll probably get an error in most systems. I certainly won't assume it exists. And the domain and range constraints aren't really constraints. They're axioms, and inferences will be drawn from them, rather than errors raised if they're violated. So one way of dealing with this is actually to say, well, let's do a representation in the OWL, which is very close to the representation that we have in the UML, and see where that takes us. And this is a horrible thing to do with our current OWL editors. So if you were ever going to do this seriously, you need some special tooling, but we can create a property to and from a class of associations, and we can define the that all associations go to a domain entity and from a domain entity. And a key thing from OWL 2 is we can put in a key statement which says that actually each association really only associates one pair of things, which is the same thing as a unique row assumption in UML, which couldn't be expressed in the original OWL. And then we can put in the notion of caused by being an association, and we can create a disorder, and we can say that it's it's a domain entity and it's caused by some agent. And we have necessarily, if we put in the information about agents, we'll get back something very close to what we had in the UML. We also can very easily get back which of the associations which are relevant to disorders and to agents, which we couldn't previously. we lose quite a bit about out of this. I've left the representation of the upper right-hand corner just as a reminder. One of them is the key declaration. We get a reasonable sense of which agents may cause disorders that we can retrieve with a description logic expression. And we can say other things about the agent, which is useful to be able to talk about about the association, such as its strength. And on the other hand, we lose, at least initially, the ability to build transitive relations in many of the inference mechanisms that we have with OWL. And we still have this problem that domain and range constraints are axioms rather than constraints. Now, it's possible to get a bit further than this. We move on to slide 17. But as a side note, and I could have written this paper equally well with frames and UML, but UML has a more convenient notation, and the particular stimulus for this talk when I put it together was UML. For association, you substitute slot, you get something very similar to what we have before. One of the things now with OWL2 that you can do with this is with property paths, you can get back the most of transitivity. And if we were to adopt, there's a paper and a group of work that was done about almost 10 years ago now by Motik and his colleagues, in which they proved that if you used true constraints rather than axioms, and you checked them in a particular way, you didn't need to check the axioms, and it all worked out. But you didn't get the unfortunate side effects that you got from axioms of accidentally. Those of you who have done the pizza tutorial will know that it's very easy to infer that, for example, that if you make the domain of has topping to be pizza, and then you say that an ice cream cone has a topping ice cream, instead of the system saying something wrong, it will say that an ice cream cone is a pizza. And that's not usually what you wanted. The other thing which OWL2 gives you is this ability to build property paths, which essentially bridge this association class in the middle, very much the way the lines in most UML diagrams bridge the implied association class, which is rarely shown. And to do that, you limit some of the things that you can do, but you retain the key thing of being able to have a transitive relation. The thing that you do have to do is, unfortunately, you would pick up this caused by in the middle. The domain would be included. The caused by, the association would be included. So almost always in your queries, you have to take when you would have wanted to say it's caused by some X. You really want to have to say, well, you want to say a domain entity and caused by some X, so you don't get back the causal association itself. This is a nasty kludge. It's an unpleasant price to have to pay, but one that's fairly easy to build into tools. I won't stop here. This is just more detail of what I've just said. The other problem that we have in OWL in these representations, and this now relates particularly the comparison of OWL and frames, is that a lot of the knowledge we want is either annotation or higher order knowledge. Templates make this quite easy to deal with. Template systems don't have a particular problem with higher order knowledge. Logic systems, usually most of the ones we do, and OWL specifically does, if you want to stay within OWL DL. there's no complete solution for this at the present time. The new work on puns in OWL 2 is a first approximation. It's one of the areas where I would personally like to see much more done than has been done. Finally, one other thing that does fall out of this is the ability to find the nearest annotation if you have the nearest association. And one of the common requirements we have in medical things is for defaults and exceptions. And there's a lot of work going on better versions of default logics. But you can actually get, if you have a well-built ontology, a long way by simply taking the most specific association in the same old sense that we did in the 80s with the work that was culminated in Koretsky's thesis of saying that you take, even if there are multiple paths, you take the one that is not overwritten by anything else. And that, we've used this very successfully in a number of things. And if you have normalized your ontology well so that each different aspect or facet is carefully modularized and separated, you can never guarantee that you won't get more than a set of more than one most specific answers. And you always have to have a conflict resolution strategy available, but the number of times in practice that it's invoked is very small. So that's an issue which, if I had longer, I would go over, but it's just another piece of... There are a number of advantages in what I am saying in actually treating properties, reifying, I hesitate to use that word because of the way it's used in RDF, in expressing properties as classes and then producing a representation which is in many ways very close to what we would do either with frames, where each frame is properly a class, each slot is properly a class, or with UML, where each association is properly a class. You also, of course, get opportunities potentially to put in information about strength of associations, which is a common requirement, and the issues about provenance, and a longer talk would be about questions about typical, which is different from May. And one of the other things which I haven't heard much discussion of is something which clearly discusses a thing which the notion which turns up in a great many medical applications. There are things which may occur and there are things which typically occur. And these are actually quite different. Pneumonia is typically caused by bacteria. It may be caused by fungi. And we wish to be able to make those sorts of statements and those sorts of distinctions in this background knowledge base, which we might, if we use this kind of technique, manage to stretch OWL to be able to do. Another argument to say is that we should just be using OWL for the ontology in the narrow sense and using some entirely other representation for these other techniques. The purpose of this piece of experimentation was to ask if we wanted to use OWL for more, could we manage to do it? So in summary, the biggest thing I want to say this talk is about is being aware of differences that people often gloss over between axioms and templates. And between ontologies in this narrow sense, while we're talking about things that are universally true and which are easily expressed in universal statements in logic, and the rest of knowledge representation, which is likely to be contingent, probabilistic, typicalistic, have all sorts of other characteristics which don't at all fit really within the, at least in a naive sense or in a straightforward sense, with the paradigms that we have in description logic. There are trade-offs between axioms and templates. Axioms give you composition, and in the sorts of things that I do, and one of the reasons for my interest in being able to stretch OWL or some other description logic representation is that I really must have and can't give up the ability to define, compose new concepts so that I really can talk about a fracture of the upper third of the anatomical neck of the left femur caused by osteoporosis secondary to renal disease. There is an ICD code for that. That's not atypical. And yet to try and produce all the combinations of such things just ends you up with there's no way of ending up with a small biomedical ontology, but we prefer not to end up with exponentially large ones. One can imagine a reconciliation and compromise using OWL along the lines that I've suggested. We've done experiments on this on a small scale, but it would take serious tooling and more effort than we've had the opportunity to do to scale it up. There's some further things that one might do to stretch the expressivity, though they put you right on the boundary of completeness. And we'd like to see more experiments done, but to do that requires more tools. So thank you very much, and that's what I have to say for this afternoon, or this morning, depending on where you're listening to this.
So thank you very much, Alan. I'm pleased to see that there is already a lot of discussion going on in the chat room, but now to start the real-life discussion around, let me draw your attention back to the big picture of this ontology summit. The title is Big Data and Semantic Web Meet Applied Ontology, and we are in a track about making use of ontologies, tools, services, and techniques. So, Alan has asked the question whether ontology is the same as knowledge representation. And from Chris's presentation, we've seen that, well, from Watson, we see that offering knowledge-rich services that draw on knowledge from the whole web doesn't necessarily need ontologies or ontology languages in the traditional sense as it's been known, say, in the ontolog community. On the other hand, we see that there is a lot of work on improving ontology languages, as we heard from Till, and there are also better ways of making use of existing ontology languages, as we learned from Alan's presentation. So let me ask a provocative question. On the web of data, are ontologies and ontology languages and tools and techniques for them, are they still relevant?
Chris Welty has asked, was your question directed to a particular person?
Oh, no, it was rather a question to the whole audience, everybody who had an opinion on this. But maybe, well, Chris, why not start with you, actually? What would you say for Watson, are ontology languages relevant?
Well, it was important for us to be able to have a standard infrastructure for sucking in data. The fact that it was largely in the same format made it much easier to find data in that format and make it test whether it was relevant to our problem or not. So in that sense, I think the answer is yes. Most advances to ontology languages that I'm aware of, however, tend to focus on things that don't really matter for the problems that my group is solving. That doesn't answer your question, but it says it's not relevant to us.
Well, thank you for this answer. So, well, let's hope ontology can still be relevant for other services. Well, I'm sure that...
Well, you didn't ask me if ontologies were relevant. You asked me if changes to ontology languages were relevant.
Yes. Sorry. I used the wrong words. And we see that there are, I mean, Till and Erlen and others do have other applications in mind, and maybe these are just different applications than Watson, and maybe not applications not as big as Watson. But what's now a question to Till? What applications could there be that aren't, well, not quite as ambitious as Watson, but that also make use of big data and that could be powered by traditional ontology languages and formal logic and the integration of this? Can you imagine something like this? Like applications that, let's say, that the distributed ontology language could power? Well then Alan Rector has put up his hand, so let's ask Alan first. Yes, please.
Okay. Well, one area in the medical, molecular biology, biomedical area, the huge efforts in collecting large genomic data and medical data on vast numbers of people, that where the information is being reported in standard nomenclatures of various sorts, and that actually is the way some of the information is being recorded. Some of it is in free text. We have two problems. One of them is even where it's being recorded in the standard classification, these things are very big and used in very different ways. And as we're working with a different talk would be on what's happening with ICD-11, we need multiple views and many more flexible ways of dealing with the standard nomenclatures than we have available at the present time. The other side of this is that we have a huge amount of the information tied up in text, and how to mix the text information, how to use in a complementary way the information that's in text and the information that's already being coded in captured and structured information is a central issue.
Here still, so a typical application that I would have in mind is an application where you have a background ontology to structure your knowledge, and basically very much in the spirit of Alan's talk, that you have also an information model that you present some structured data to the user. For example, I myself have been participating in some Google Maps like wayfinding and routing framework where you could have more complex queries like I want to go to the cinema and afterwards drink a beer, and then I need an ATM to get some money, and please find me a route for that. And then you would need an ontology to look up what your notions are, but you would also need a kind of, say, a UML model modeling your data in your application. And then it would be useful to have a link between the OWL ontology and the UML data model. And data models are different from ontologies. And I think, I very much agree to Alan's talk there. And for example, OntoIOP and DOL could help there with suitable translations between UML and OWL, for example, so that you could make this relation more precise and most importantly, to get it supported.
Can you be more specific about where you find the OntoIOP tools? Was that in the presentation? It all went by just quickly enough that I'm not clear on what is actually currently available.
Sorry, could you repeat the question? I only got it half.
Are the Onto IOP tools currently available, or are they a plan for tools to be built?
They are already available. So you can also use IOP, say, OWL and Common Logic. That's possible. Unfortunately, it's not possible to interoperate between OWL and UML. But this is the framework for doing this is there.
Actually, that would be one of the ones that would be very interesting.
Uh-huh.
From our point of view.
Yeah, so I'm very much interested in cooperating with you about these translations between OWL and UML class diagrams, say, what is really needed there and what would be useful translations, because there's already a lot of literature about such translations. And to me, it's not clear what are the most useful ones. We would actually implement them in tools.
Well, I would be very interested in carrying on that discussion offline if you would get in touch.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting aspect that you've just mentioned too about ways of making OWL and UML interoperable. But let me pass this back to Chris Welty now. To what you are having in mind, I'm familiar with this to some extent, is that is a formal translation from OWL to UML. But now, if I think back at the Watson presentation, there might be some knowledge about the world that's modeled in OWL ontologies. There might be other knowledge about the world that's modeled in UML class diagrams, and for answering real world questions the way like Watson does it, is it actually helpful to establish a formal 100% confident translation between OWL and UML, or would a more flexible way of interpreting OWL and UML be needed?
For answering real world questions, it's of no importance whatsoever to be able to translate it between UML and OWL. It's not relevant to this kind of space. I don't see why you would think it might be.
Mm.
It doesn't matter to us what format the knowledge is in.
Mm-hmm. Well, suppose some knowledge that were useful for playing Jeopardy were available in OWL ontologies, and some other knowledge were available in UML diagrams. Would you rather be, would Watson rather be interested in a formal theoretical translation between OWL and UML, or would it take a more flexible approach to make sense out of these formal representations?
A more flexible approach is required. If you're going to language, you have to understand that there's always errors. So we tend not to care too much about overly formalized knowledge in any particular repository, because the kinds of distinctions that formalists make are never made in language. So there's no way to figure out how they correspond to each other. So we're looking for knowledge that's represented in a way that captures something that's very likely to be asked about, and people don't tend to ask questions about really subtle distinctions. Also, the whole idea of proof by negation, which a lot of semantics preserving translations try to account for, is completely nonsense in a big data world or in a language world. There's really no way you can prove something from its, the idea of proof by negation doesn't hold in this world.
Okay. Well, thank you for this explanation. Now, there is a question by Michael Gruninger.
Yes, this is a question for Chris. So, if you think of Watson as being then a sophisticated information retrieval system working on unstructured data, if you're looking at other domains where you not only have to do some information retrieval, but do, say, diagnosis if it's a medical domain or maybe some kind of optimization if it's, you're looking at a smart city or supply chain domain. Do you think that would lead to some kind of KR inside the engine in order to answer a question that's more than just retrieval?
Well, by KR, do you mean just the R or the K?
No, you can stick with the K.
Yeah, so we use knowledge quite extensively, and that's the point I'm trying to make in my talks, that it's not used in the way that a lot of visionaries imagined formal representations would be used. We don't represent the meaning of language using logic, but we use pre-existing knowledge that has been represented. We sort of throw out most of the axioms because, again, the large problem we have is trying to get from the way language uses symbols to the way logical theories, ontologies, taxonomies, et cetera, use symbols. And the error rate at doing that just makes any of the other stuff irrelevant.
Right, but again, some of the applications that you might be considering, again, do they move beyond, like I say, more this kind of sophisticated information retrieval on unstructured data to kinds of domains like diagnostic, medical diagnostic, or other sorts of things where, you know, people do think of there being some reason. The answer's not there in the documents. It requires you to synthesize and actually add more steps to what you can find in the documentation in that unstructured data.
Right, but it doesn't require logical reasoning the way it's been characterized by the KR community for the past half a century. Reasoning, yes, but not deduction the way it's typically implemented. People don't work that way either. Only a few of us.
I'm telling Spock on you.
No.
Well, I'm actually wondering, is there anybody from the ontology learning community in this room? Might be interesting to hear some input from this community, learning formal ontologies from unstructured texts.
Yes, I'm here.
Hmm.
What would you like to know? I have to go in 1 minute.
Yeah, well, then let me already say thank you very much for your presentation and for participating in the discussion and providing so much input for the discussion. Well, we'll hope to see you soon again in an ontology summit session. So thank you very much for today.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
John, yes, please?
I have a question for Alan and or anyone, really. It's the general question concerning the notion of reifying properties. I'm wondering about, as properties are reified, what the impact is on the set of properties that remain in one's ontology. Does it basically end up with a set of properties that are some combination of verbs and prepositions, the notion being that, I could see the great benefit of reifying properties is terrific, but I'm curious about the impact on the resulting set of properties that remain. If you could discuss that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I can make comments from the things that we've done. And we end up with, on the one hand, obviously a large number of properties there are two possibilities. One of them is a large number of properties disappear completely, and you end up with one set that are non-transitive and that are essentially to and from, and a transitive to and from. And then you end up with the remaining properties, which tend to correspond to something like the attributes in a UML diagram, that it's not worth the trouble to reify. And it's only really worth reifying the, what I might call the structural properties, the things like which the laterality, for instance, of left and right, isn't worth reifying unless it is happening because you're using some sort of generic transformation mechanism, and it just happens by mechanically. And it's easier to do it rather than not. But usually you end up with the partitioning between those that are important, which are roughly speaking the things that would be associations in UML, and those things which are local, which are remain specific to a given, which remain just as properties. But that varies with how people do it. The other thing which sometimes happens is if you're trying to preserve additional distinctions between details that use some of the property reasoning that's possible in OWL, you may end up with a subproperty for each association, or a pair of subproperties for each association, so that you can attach additional property characteristics to them, and then rewrite rules have to be in place in the tool so that the right subproperties get used with the right associations, and that makes it much more complicated. We used to have to do that much more in OWL 1. In OWL 2, there's much less need to do that, but there are still cases where that comes out. But in general, you end up with a modest set of properties. The more serious question is being careful about how you do it, and you do need to do some experimentation, depending on what reasoner you're using, with whether anything you're doing has dreadful impact on reasoning times for the particular things that you're doing. There are certain constructs which can produce serious reasoning hang-ups, though the new conclude reasoner seems to be immune to most of them. I haven't had enough experience with it yet to have tested it against all of the hard cases, but they seem to have, I don't know what they're doing, but it seems to be remarkably fast and robust.
Okay, there is another question in the queue by Eric, and I'd say we take, well, this question and probably one more, and then we have to end the session. Eric, please.
Yes. We worked on mapping UML to OWL model for ICOM, that's the Integrated Collaboration Object Model. It's a standard that we are developing in OASIS DC. We are extending the current model with social networking features, and we find that if we reify the property, we can then associate privacy visibility attributes to those properties. So, for example, one declared the association to an item in terms of like or friend or whatever, you can control the visibility of that property among your circles of friends. So reification helped with that model. So also earlier I heard that there will be an offline discussion around the mapping between UML and OWL. Could you include me? And I think Ken Baklowski will be interested also. He and I are co-chairing that DC for ICOM model. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. These are helpful pointers. So any last words by anybody? 3, 2, 1. Otherwise, I think it's time to conclude this session. Let me thank very much again the speakers, Chris Welty, who has left already, and the two other speakers who are still in this room, Till Mosakowski and Alan Rector. Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for this productive discussion. Let's continue this on the mailing list to find out how we can make use of ontologies, whether we can make use of ontologies, on the web of big data using tools, techniques, and services. Let's continue this. And in this track, we meet again on the 13th of March. And, well, as Peter has just announced, in 1 week, there will be the first session of
of track C. So hope to see a lot of you again. Thank you. And thanks, Peter, for managing the session.
Thank you.